It's January 17th, 2017, Tuesday Night Live.
Okay. We'll do something in Shemos. This week we start the second book of the Torah. Last week we finished Bereshis called Genesis. And the theme of Bereshis is the creation of the world, and that's co-joined with, I guess you could say, another creation, that's the Jewish people. The Jewish people is a special creation of God in that it's different than any other nation. All nations, if you're going to trace their history, you'll see that whatever it is, it came about through the confluence, interactions of natural forces. I'm not making a statement that God did not play a role in the establishment of certain nations. I'm not saying that. But by and large, there's no essential principle that a nation can only come into being because of divine providence. It's like any other phenomenon in the natural order of things. So you have groups, associations come together, separate, fight wars, and so on and so forth. And this is mainly, by and large, a result of the laws of nature, in the human realm, that is, of course. As I said, it doesn't rule out divine providence, but we don't know all aspects. We don't take the position that everything that happened in this world is the direct result of a direct will of God. A man has free will. However, the principle is different when it comes to the Jewish people. The Jewish people did not come into being simply because of the natural causes. You could see the fact that they even exist at all is contrary to ordinary laws of nature. It's a family. You don't find the family of... when they came down to Egypt, there were 70 souls, and they don't even have their own territory, and so forth, and all the things that occurred and happened until they emerged as a nation. And the very exodus from Egypt is a result of direct divine intervention. So in the first book, which is Bereshis, it's the creation of the world and the establishment of the covenant with Abraham, which is going to lead to the establishment of a very special nation. And I think that those two themes are connected because God created the world to achieve a certain, not that God wanted to achieve a certain, we can't go into questions as to why God. We're going to start using like what motivated God and so on and so forth, then we're completely off track. Because then we're just projecting our own nature onto God. So in his wisdom, he decided to do it. We don't know why. But that's not the crucial question. When he created it with a design and a purpose that it's supposed to fulfill. He assigned it. Like all the elements in the world, the natural order, are supposed to function in a certain way. The animals, for example, they were given a certain design, a makeup, and they fulfill God's will when they act in accordance with their nature. The same is true for man and the human order, that it's not as though, and I'm using descriptive terms, it's not as though God created you and he's completely indifferent to what you do with your life. That's not the point. He created you with a certain design and you fulfill his will when you achieve, when self-fulfillment, that is to say. When you achieve the goal that he created you for in accordance with your design. And, I mean, it says so in Bereshis at the beginning that he created the human in his image, which is a reference to the divine soul, male and female created them. He gave you a very specific, unique makeup. And if you ignore that and you just live an instinctual existence, you're not living a human existence. The goal is to live a truly human existence. Of course, it's not so easy to find out. Obviously, all of our study, that's the Torah, is to try and discover what exactly human existence ought to be. And then to fulfill it, achieve it to the best of our ability. So that takes place in the first book. The second book of Shemos is taking it to the next level. And that is the emergence, the development of the Jewish people, the age of the patriarchs, and the 12 sons. The 12 sons are the building blocks of the nation. So you could see that whole pattern from great individuals, and then you have the building blocks, the leaders. Because the nation originally was supposed to be broken up into different tribes. Sort of like, I guess, the idea of the United States. It's not just one group of people, but it breaks down into different, we call them states, and so on. That's essentially the main theme of the Book of Shemos. The development of the Jewish people, their emergence, of course, Sinai, the receiving of the Torah at Sinai, and the building of the Mishkan, by the way, the tabernacle is also part of the story. It's extremely important. So we're going to start with Shemos. And again, in its very terse fashion, it tells us what happened. What happened to the children of Israel? All right, so it begins by mentioning the names of the 12 sons who came down to Egypt. And concludes that, this is, by verse 3, it says that all the souls who came, the children of Yaakov were 70 souls, and Joseph was in Egypt. All right. Then it says that Yosef and all of his brothers died, and that entire generation. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. So you see, like, that's the way history works. There's different generations, different people, and certain things becomes the way of life. And people, that's another thing that's very important, because people think that the way things are, it's the way it's going to be. This is the way it's going to be forever. And that's not what history is about. To the contrary, there's tremendous change and turbulence. And systems or states which seem so stable and so enduring that they're going to last forever. And then there's the winds of change. And we're subject to the same thing. This is a side note that, in America is like, for the last 50, 60 years has been the world power and so on. And so we start to take things for granted. But I don't know what, I'm not making a political comment, but we're going through a lot of change, the way I see it. I mean, the way the country is functioning now on a national level is completely different than anything I've been accustomed to. I mean, I'm referring to like a new election, a new administration. I mean, the turbulence and the degree of fighting about it, whether it's legitimate, not legitimate, things that this never occurred before, even in very hard fought battles, but there was underneath it all, there was this desire to, unite and keep the country moving. And I see a change. Whether it means anything in the long run, we'll see. But we shouldn't just take it for granted, everything will be okay, no problem. I don't think that's the correct attitude. Yeah, go ahead.
No, lots of times.
The thing I would say is that when there is tremendous turbulence and or revolution or things are uprooting, generally speaking, it's not good for the Jews. It's the general rule. The Jews pray for for the safety of the government, whatever it is, whether we like the don't like. No. We pray for because the stability of society is much better. When things are in turmoil, it brings out all of these, repressed, not so repressed, anger, hatred, and then a scapegoat is needed, and the Jew is always much, you see that in Europe. I mean, all the turmoil that Europe is going through, it's not good for the Jews, which causes a lot of aliyah, a lot of Jews leaving, going to Israel. Jews in America have this sense of confidence. Look at the way we're treated in America with all the rights and acceptance and so forth. But there are manifestations of anti-Semitism, maybe not at the most serious level, but more so than there's been recently. So we can never take our situation for granted either. All right, so now what happens over here is one of these changes, major league changes that are going on. And it has to do with the death. The Torah very briefly enumerates the causes of the change, because the Jews had it good in Egypt. They had it great in Egypt. They had Paro. As long as Paro who appointed Yosef had this tremendous sense of beholdenness to Yosef. He invited him to bring down his family, gave them the land of Goshen, the best situation. So I'm sure they had to feel a certain sense of security. And that, but you see, that situation depended upon certain factors. It depended upon the existence of that Paro, and that he would remain the way he was. Uh-huh. All right, let's take the literal reading that he died. All right, I know there's another interpretation that is a midrash. Midrashic. The plain interpretation is that he actually died, because he's not going to live forever. He died. And that generation, in other words, the two parties who were responsible for this mutual situation of, you know, security and good relations, both of them are not going to be there forever. So it says that Yosef died and all of his brothers and that entire generation. So it's a new generation. Then it says that the children of Israel, this is a very interesting verse, it says that they multiplied and increased. It's a number of different adjectives for the same thing. Describes a tremendous period of growth. And they became extremely strong, meaning numerically, but not just numerically, they were, practically speaking, became powerful people. And the land became filled with them. They needed space. They expanded. So what the Torah is trying to tell you, and this is very, very important, because you're dealing with 70 souls, and eventually there's going to be like, I don't know, a million and a half people, or 2 million people. I don't know the exact number when they leave Egypt. So you have a nation. You have the dimensions of a nation, a small nation. I don't know what's the size of the smallest nation. I don't know.
Not 2 million people, probably.
You could have, you know.
I mean, Luxembourg probably doesn't have 2 million people.
Has less than that?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, so if you have a million and a half people, okay, it's a small, but it's legitimate.
Right, right.
And that's what was needed, going to be a nation. So this takes place not in the longest, you know, they have to go through a tremendous, extraordinary period of growth.
Right, unnatural.
Unnatural.
Has to be.
With divine providence.
It has to be divine.
Because it says, I mean, women bore so many children. It's not that crazy, because you do have, you go to places with essentially amongst Hasidic groups where, you know, people have 10, 15 children.
Right, right.
It's not considered.
You have multiple births, you still need about 9 months in between each child so on. And
you need, so well, they had a couple of hundred years to do all this exponential growth. Yes. But, I mean, everything's got to really be working great, and the children have to survive and grow and continue in this process. Mm-hmm. But it has a negative. Now the negatives begin to set in. See, because when the Jews are doing too well and too successful and too expansion, it gets people's attention. We don't want to get people's attention too much, right, drawn to ourselves. And this is exactly what happened. Then it says a new king arose over Egypt. Okay? And it says a strange thing, who did not know Yosef. Who did not know Yosef. So, as I said before, there is an interpretation that says that it's really the same king, but he acted as though he didn't know Yosef. I'm not going to work with that, because as I said, that's not the plain meaning of the text. It's actually a new king. But I find it strange that how would he not know Yosef? I mean, what is he, stupid? What is he, ignorant? It's not that long ago. He should know the basic history of his country. You'd think he would know. It would be strange.
Is it part of the history?
It's part of the history.
Is it a part of Egypt's history?
I would imagine. I mean, who came along and erased it from the history? I don't think that's the case. Because I don't see any reason why at this point, maybe this king, until now we haven't read about the king being anti-Semitic, anti-Jew.
Right.
So why anybody that came along would know the history? It's recent history. I would interpret it as follows. I don't know him. Sometimes a person doesn't like another person and doesn't want to acknowledge or recognize him, even though he really does know him.
Yeah.
And then someone comes along and says, oh, did you know, you hear about so-and-so? I don't know him. In other words, I don't recognize him. I don't want to know about him. It's as though... Now, I would say a similar thing over here, that maybe he's part of a new generation. So he may have known, maybe studied in history. In history, you learn a lot of facts, but they are of no significance to you. You know, I was just thinking that it's an interesting thing, that today's generation, we, from our generation, or my generation at least, so we knew Patton, we knew MacArthur, we knew Eisenhower, we knew because we were raised, that it was right after the Second World War. I was born in 44, so when I was a kid, it was the whole effect of the Second of the Heroes, and you learn that these were great people. You learned about these great people. And certainly at that time, FDR, you know, these were people that were great. We knew about them. But now, ask a kid who's George Patton. He doesn't know what you're talking about.
Right.
All right?
They're gone.
They're gone and forgotten.
If you don't read about them in the history books, yes. You don't know.
Unless you are of a particular interest in the field, in the history, and you start to read it, then they're of no... But unfortunately... I see, that's why I think that O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly's books on history, if you've read any of them, are really good. Killing, okay, he brings it, and then he writes a kid's version of the same thing, and he writes it in a very exciting way. So a lot of kids do get turned on as through that, to be interested. Unfortunately, history is taught very dry and boring, and it should be the most fascinating subject, but that's the way it is. So you could say a new king came along. He's from a different generation. He didn't live through the famine. He didn't care about it. Exactly. He didn't know him. In other words, he may have known about him on a factual level, but he wasn't important. That sense of, Yosef, because Yosef is such a great Egyptian iconic figure, and therefore his descendants, the Jews, they did so much for the country, that he didn't have that thing. That he doesn't know about that.
That's history. That's what it is.
Yeah, it's history.
Old news.
That's old news, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So then he says, he speaks to his people, and he says, behold, the nation of the children of Israel. See, he's referring to them already as a nation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They are greater and more powerful than us. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I don't think he means that literally, because at that point they weren't. But I think he means they're going to become. If they keep going at this pace, they are going to become greater and more powerful. Something bothered him about the Jews. We don't even know what it was. We don't know what turned them against the Jews. Did he have an experience with them? And so nothing specific. He just seems to be saying that they are outpacing us. They're a danger, they're a problem. We have to start thinking about, we have to nip it in the bud. So he says, come and let us deal wisely with them, lest they increase. See, he's concerned about the increase. But if he meant that right now they're greater and more powerful, so what are you saying, lest they increase? We don't have to worry. It's here already. The problem's here. No. Lest they increase. And then, if there should occur a war, then he will join together with our enemy and fight against us. And this next part can be read, go up from the land, or it can be read that we'll go up and drive us out of the land. Okay. In other words, this accusation is going to be repeated time and again throughout history. The Jews are being accused of being a fifth column. The Jews always suffered this way because from most of the history of the exile, when the Jews are in exile, they're in somebody else's land. And inevitably, because it's the nature of the Jews to stick together. So they... Until America, I mean, they're generally don't assimilate. They're very identifiable. They're very much overachievers, and they have their own customs. You know, whatever those who keep the. So inevitably, it arouses a certain type of a jealousy, and that doesn't take long until it becomes envy and hatred, and then the accusation that they're sponging off of us. They're parasites. That's always been. That's the general. And that they're disloyal as well. We can't count on them. They're disloyal.
What makes them think that we're...
That's a very good question. The question being raised is, why would he take such an attitude? it's not true, and wouldn't he be better off getting them on his side to help him out? And so on and so on. That's a very good question. And you see the same thing throughout history. Even in books have been written on this subject, even in World War II, Hitler, had he, what he lost by getting rid of all the Jews like Einstein and so on and so forth, the great, the genius, the industrial capabilities, and this, but you know, had he not had this anti-Semitic policy, he just wanted to take over the world. He wasn't going to. So, and had he befriended the Jews and made use of their talents, not to mention how much it took away from the war effort to have this whole Holocaust and all the resources and so on and so forth that it took. So that's a good question.
Yeah.
But the answer presupposes that he's rational. The answer, but he's not rational.
It doesn't sound like Paro is rational.
Paro is not rational. No, and this is a very fundamental principle that emerges. Anti-Semitism is a form of insanity. You have to come to that conclusion. It's a form of insanity because all the charges that they make, and even today with the UN and all the condemnations of Israel, you have, take a look what's going on in Syria. You have a genocide going on there. And it's in Libya. And you're in a region where everybody's killing and oppressing and violent. ISIS, nothing, no discussion. The only problem is what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. What they're doing. The Arabs, they have the ones that have it the best are the ones that live in Israel and are Israeli citizens. So why can't, these are not just the Arabs who hate, but this is all of France and this is all the European countries. So, isn't that a form of insanity? Whatever you want to say about the Jews, they're not the criminal element. You have in Chicago, you have tremendous amount of crime. Lawlessness is in the black community. That's the fact. I'm not anti-anything. I'm not anti-black for saying that. And you go to, anyone will tell you, you go to any city, what area would a black cop want to patrol in? A black neighborhood or a Jewish neighborhood? There's no question about it.
Yeah, of course.
Because the Jews have the lowest, crime rates. Maybe they get sometimes in the economic crisis, stuff like that, you know. I would say it's relatively low there too, but they don't have street crime. So why would people create all of these defamations and demonizations of the Jew? It's just false. And it's not difficult to disprove. So you have to say that the hatred has in it, which blinds people. And it, in my opinion, it's clearly a paranoid thing. They accused Jews of blood, using Christian children's blood to bake in matzahs. I mean, go through the history of the anti-Semitism and you'll see insanity. So, anyone who's anti-Semitic is basically suffering from, it's a disease, it's a mental disease. And I'm, quite comfortable to say a thing like that. That's what it is. Because exaggeration, distortion, etc.
I'd like if they could be cured.
America, so far, we have not suffered serious anti-Semitism. Maybe in the last 40, 50 years. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that America is so diverse and has so many different groups, and the whole idea of bigotry and racism is really frowned upon to a tremendous extent. That's like the worst crime. So that helps us as well. Because you can't preach against anything, gender, equality. So you can't preach against it's bias. Anything which is called bias.
Right.
And so as a result, it's going to carry over to Jews as well. To be an anti-Semite is a bigot. That's a disgusting thing.
Yeah.
But how long that will last, I don't know. Eventually, another story. It's always good to throw in a story. When I was living back in New York, living in Far Rockaway. All right, so that's about, 20, 25 years ago. I don't know when this story, when it happens. I started getting phone calls, hate calls, with Nazi-like overtones, Hitler and killing this and that was really very, very harsh. And it was like getting pretty frequent, So... At one point I answered and I like really answered back in kind,
Yeah.
And sort of like, why don't you come over, you know, if you have a problem with me, why don't you come over and I'll blow your brains out. So, yeah. Actually, I had a shotgun at the time.
Yes.
But then someone said, you know, I should report it to the police.
Exactly. That's what I was going
to
say.
So I did report it to the police. Mm-hmm. And the way I reported it, that it was extremely anti-Semitic, you know, and Holocaust references and Hitler didn't kill enough of you, you know, that kind of stuff. So a delegation, not just a couple of police officers came by to get a routine report. The police chief, the local chief, and top people came down and they interviewed this and that, getting, and they said, yeah, this is a hate crime, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
And they really were on top of it. I got phone calls from the attorney general, the office, and what's been happening. It's just for some crazy reason, I don't know why, from that point on that they visited the house, the phone call ceased. So I don't know. It could have been I don't know who it was. It could have been a prank. Somebody from the neighborhood, whatever. I do not know
right.
why, what the connection was.
Yeah, yeah.
But from the time that they came to the house, I never got another call. But there were so many follow-up calls from officials. I never got, there was such concern and this and that. What's been happening? Keep up to date. Are you satisfied with the way we're dealing? Yeah. Because this is a hate crime. Mm-hmm. And a hate crime became the biggest,
yes.
you know, thing. Yes. So I'm just using it as an illustration that that's part of the climate, which
right.
we benefit from.
That's what
which
we don't benefit want from. To change, exactly.
So that was the obsession. This was the insanity, that he had to be afraid of the Jews and he had to cut their growth. So then he went through a few phases. So at first he appointed taskmasters over them in order to afflict them with their burdens. In other words, he gave them tasks. It wasn't the full-fledged enslavement that it was
right.
going to become.
Yeah.
Like it was in the form of a tax, but building. They had to be involved in building these structures. So they built the storage cities, Pitom and Ramses. They built them. That was the Jews. So I assume the idea was that they have to show their loyalty to Egypt and so on and so forth. But it says that the more he afflicted them, as much as they would afflict them, so they continued. It didn't stop them.
Yeah.
They continued to grow,
sure.
increase, and spread out.
Sure.
And so then they became disgusted. Because here we're trying to put you down, trying to slow you down, it's not affecting you. So there's an increase in the anger towards them. Then it says that the next step was that they afflicted them with harsh labor. They embittered their lives with hard work. Mortar, bricks, with every labor of the field. So you can see it's gotten worse. It's not static, it's getting much, much worse. But that's the way it is. You know, first you start off with milder forms of repression, then already the victim is predisposed already. It's easier to impose greater burdens. Okay, all the labors that they performed with them were with crushing harshness. Okay. But that wasn't enough, apparently, because this stage, there was another part of the plot. And the plot was genocide. That's what he sought to do. He sought to do it. And the king of Egypt then spoke to the midwives, those who were midwives for the Jewish children. It's not clear whether these midwives themselves were Jewish or they were Egyptian, but it makes more sense to say that they were Jewish. In fact, the rabbis say that it's really Miriam and Yocheved. The Torah is referring to them by the names Shifra and Pua, but really they were Miriam and Yocheved. And he said to them, when you assist in the birth, when you deliver the Jewish women, and you see they're on the birth stool, I had some kind of birth stool, if it's a son, then you should kill him. If it's a boy, you should kill him.
Right.
And if it's a girl, you should keep her alive. Mm-hmm. So, why? What's the rationale behind it? I would imagine that he wanted to destroy the future of this people. Mm-hmm. So the strength of the nation, the defenders, the fighters, etc., are going to be the men. Once you get rid of the men, then you can keep the women, we can take them, they could become assimilated, whatever the case may be. In other words, they weren't afraid of the Jewish women,
right. But
they were afraid of the Jewish men. So that was the plan. The plan was to sort, but there was secrecy involved. There had to be secrecy involved. Same thing with the Nazis when they first, you know, the genocide. They tried to maintain the secrecy. They had special camps, and they were in, and so on and so forth. He didn't want this to be public knowledge. That's why you'll get them while they're in the process of giving birth. You'll do some, you know, choke the kid, whatever you do. And then they won't know. They'll assume it died in childbirth.
Yes.
I don't know, there's some kind of a disease here that's afflicting the Jewish male children.
Right, and it probably would have looked weird if all the children died.
It might have looked weird, but then at this stage of the game, I don't know how long it's going to last or how far it's going to go, but it was serious because at the time that Moshe was born, it was in effect. As we see, because then he, well, let's see, let's, I wanted, tonight I wanted to emphasize the encounter with the midwives.
Yeah.
So, but it says that the midwives feared God, which as I said, that would lend more credence to the idea that they're Jewish or that they're Miriam and Yocheved. So they were very heroic people. And they did not do as the king of Egypt had instructed, the king of Egypt, which is telling you that this takes a tremendous amount of courage to resist the explicit orders of the king. And they kept alive. They kept them alive. Well, that would seem to be, of course, if they didn't do what he told them, so of course they kept them alive. It's telling you more. In other words, it's not just that they didn't kill him,
right. But...
So you let the kid be born, but you don't have to give him such good treatment. No, they kept him alive. They really ministered. They took really good care of the children. So they went tremendously against the order of the king. Which shows, it's interesting, it tells you that they feared God. The fear of God is very important over here. And the reason why it says that they feared God, you might say, well, one second, but these are women, and women aren't going to go killing babies. And well, even if they don't fear God, the reason is no. If they didn't, even if they were decent people and sympathetic, decency and sympathy and so on will take you so far.
Yeah.
But when you're in a crisis, and your life, your very life is in danger, well, what could I do?
Right, it's my life or yeah. His life.
That's the ordinary, common morality.
Yes.
But when you fear God, it's a whole different.
Then it's your life.
Then I have to answer to God. Then it's my life, exactly.
Right.
So that's why it mentions that the reason, the motive behind their resistance was that they feared God. Not that they were good people.
Right.
Because yeah. In the story, well, they were very nice people, very sympathetic, and they didn't know. Then they would have listened. Because what can I do?
Yeah.
But when it's an absolute, God is telling me not to do it, and Pharaoh is telling me to do it, I have to listen to God.
It got it.
So that itself is a tremendously inspiring idea. That ultimately, the only absolute that we have in the battle against evil is the fear of God. Anything else, anything short of that is not going to give us the type of strength and courage to do it. But let's see what happens. They now have to answer. They have an encounter. So the king of Egypt called the midwives. See, it's not referring as Paro, it's the king of Egypt.
Yeah.
King.
Why is that?
No, because it wants you to know, don't forget for a second, that they're going to have to give an accounting to the king.
Yeah.
That's why it's mentioned, the king.
But Paro was king.
Yeah, he was the king.
So I don't get why.
No, I'm saying, I understand that. But if it just, you, when you talk about him, as you refer to him as Paro, you're referring to him as a human being. It's less frightening.
Oh, okay.
When you're referring to him as the king of Egypt, then it's in his different... Because sometimes a president, a leader, you can call him by name. He's not that, you know, not that fearful, not that fearsome. But when you use the word king, we mean in his fearsome, in his kingly estate. And he said to them, why have you done this? And you've kept alive the children. So why have you done this thing? That's one question. Why have you done this thing means that you didn't kill them. That's one. But then he also, not only did you not kill them, but you also kept them alive. You went out of your way. That's a double violation.
Mm-hmm.
Insubordination against his orders.
Right.
Okay. So now most people will be trembling. What am I going to... What am I going to say? How am I going to get out of this? He's got the goods. But you see, a great part of the greatness of a person, and that's part of the story, a truly great person who fears God is acting on a different plane. And not only do they resist, but they're in a very, very calm state in which they can use their minds to the best of their ability to not they don't give in to panic. They don't give in to fear, even of a great king. And you could see from their answer, they had a brilliant answer. And they got away with it, essentially. Well, what was their answer? Their answer was, and the midwives, this is verse 19, the midwives said to Paro, for the Jewish women are not like the Egyptians. They're different. Because they're very adept, so to speak. They're experts. I mean, in the matter of children. Mm-hmm. They know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. So, before the midwife gets to them, they've already given birth. In other words, they made up the story, which was not true, mm-hmm. that there's something, that, when it comes to this business, they know what they're doing and they're very adept. And they're very quick and efficient, and by the time you get to them, they've already given. So it's too late.
Right.
It's too late because if we're going to kill them then, it's going to be known, and you don't want it to be known. It's supposed to be a secret. Mm-hmm. So that was a brilliant answer. Because in effect, they were saying, and that's something he could hear because he's already depicting the Jews as being different, strange, unusual. That people have always projected all these, whatever, magical kinds of powers onto Jews. So that's something he would hear. Because he has this attitude. And also they're saying, well, what can we do? We're not rebelling against your orders, but it's not possible to carry it out.
Yeah, he needed secrecy. That was the thing, right?
That's correct.
And this doesn't sound like it's going to be a secret because...
Yeah, then they'll see. If they're already given birth and we kill the child, so then they know the child was a healthy child and now it's dead?
Now how did Miriam...
Now what happens next? So then it mentions that that God was good to the midwives and rewarded them. Let's just pause for a second, though, before we go any further. Because it's very interesting to note that they were able to get away with it. All right, then he began to tell the other Egyptians. He gave up on this plan. He no longer demanded that the midwives... But then he ordered the nation at large when they saw, if they saw a Jewish baby. That's why when Moshe was born, the decree was in effect. That's another story that the commentators point out, but we have to assume that at a certain point, the decree was rescinded, even though it's not described. Because the Jews continued to grow. And okay, I have a theory about that, but we're not going to take that up right now. The question I want to raise is that Paro had two charges against them. One is that you didn't carry out my order. That is, you didn't kill the children. And the second one was that not only didn't you do that, but you actually helped the kids. You know, you took care of them, you strengthened them, and so on and so forth. Now, it would seem that the midwives only answered the first question. They said, we can't kill them because by the time we get there, the kid's born already. That's basically the answer. Right. Yeah, but they didn't answer as to why did we keep them alive. And he seems to drop that issue. Well, I mean, I would expect that he would say, okay, fine, you couldn't do that, but hold it a second. Isn't it true that you took care of them, you fed them, you diapered them, you gave them the best possible care? That he doesn't come back to, that they get away with. There was, as I said, there were two questions that he asked.
Right.
That's my question. I want to go through some of the commentary of the Ralbag. Those are the initials. Yeah. A medieval commentator, one of the great commentators. And it's very unique. He has a very, very interesting commentary because he lines it up. He gives an elucidation of the story, and then he he lists the benefits, which then makes it very, very effective. Like, what did we learn from this? Because a lot of times you read stories, this and that, and you're trying to pull something out. He has on every section the benefits. Moral teachings and ethical teachings and so on and so forth. So he says this is the number three, the third benefit is, he says, that a person should never agree to do terrible deeds. And even though he's tremendously pressured, and even if he's commanded from the ruler, because that's very, very important teaching. When they had the after World War II and the Nazis and the Charles, everybody was following, nobody did anything wrong. They all followed orders, and that was the excuse. I didn't know nothing, I just followed orders. But he's saying that that's not an excuse. When it comes to doing evil things, you can't follow orders. And why? Because he says it's more appropriate that you should fear God. That's the one that you should fear. So fear of God is expressed by not listening, not demonstrating fear for humans. Because God is the ruler over the ruler that's talking to you. Okay, so he says, and thus you see that the Mialdos never agreed to do it. That's a very, that step, that decision, they didn't just go along, and act impulsively. They made a conscious decision of what we have to do. Okay? And that's because the fact is that they feared God. Now, the next benefit, he says, I'm just going to go through it quickly. He says, it's not appropriate that a person should rely on a miracle. Well, that's a general principle in Judaism. We're not permitted to rely on miracles. So whenever a situation occurs, we can't just sit back and pray. First, we have to do whatever we can do. And then you pray, obviously. Then you pray. But to begin with, you have to try to solve it. Do whatever you can do in the natural framework. And even if you're doing something even when you're doing a mitzvah, and you're doing the right thing, you're resisting a king and you're saving lives, still, you can't, even in that situation, you can't, well, God's certainly going to help me because I'm doing his bidding. No. You can never rely on a miracle. But rather, a person should strive with all their might to save himself, distance himself from any kind of consequences. You get that. Therefore, he said, you find that the midwives explain. They spoke to the king of Egypt in a manner that he wouldn't get angry at them. In other words, it tells it to us very briefly, but this took a lot of thought. What are we going to say to them? They didn't just come in unprepared. They knew, and they thought it through. And he says they acted with tremendous wisdom. Because, first of all, they said that the Jewish women are not like the Egyptian ones, because they're very adept. And before we can even get there, they've already given birth. And this was a tremendous explanation. He thinks this was a brilliant explanation to explain why they hadn't killed the children. And he says, perhaps it also served to answer the other charge that Paro leveled against them. That is, that they took care of the children. He's going to show you that this answer that they gave to the primary question also covered the second question. And that's why Paro didn't come after them for the second question. And he's going to show you how. He says, because once the male child was born, is what they're saying, they had no way of killing him in secrecy. And if they didn't, in other words, they're sort of saying, the way we understand your plan is that this must be carried out in secrecy, so that the mothers won't have any sense that, this is a plot. Okay? So, if we change, in other words, if we can get there early enough, fine. But we can't by the time we get there. Now, once we come and they're born, if we were to make any kind of change in the treatment, that the Jewish boys didn't get the right treatment, that the Egyptians, then it sensed that there's something going on, and that would spoil your entire plan. It would no longer be a secret. So we have to go out of our way to give the child the best possible treatment so that they won't be suspicious and they'll trust us and we can carry out your plan. So he says that was a brilliant type of an answer. Because they used his logic. In other words, the best possible thing is to show that I've accepted your plan, I understand what your plan is, and I'm going to implement it. And in order to implement that plan, I have to do such and such. You see, even the Germans, even in the concentration camps, they had to do certain things to allay the fears of the Jews and then fool the world. So when the Jews came in there, they had a marching, they had a band, and this and that, pretending that they were going to be welcome, that it's going to be Arbeit macht frei, work will make you free, all these kinds of things. Of course, it was, to deceive them and to make them docile and not to suspect. But he's saying that that this answer that they gave really was, once you understand the answer, it really removed the second question as well. And thus he says that they were very unusual people. And because they had this fear of God, it enabled them to function on the highest possible level. And that's what a person has to do. That is to say, it's not enough to simply, because I fear God, I'm not going to do that terrible deed. And that's it. Okay, that's all I can. No. That's not enough. You have to then retain your calm, because the job is not over. The job is not over by merely not doing something, because you're going to have to account for it. You're going to have to give an answer. You can't give in to any sense of panic. The faith that you display in God must manifest itself in how you act after you do the great deed. And that's the story of the Mialdos, of the midwives. And as a result of this, God rewarded them. Let's just read two more verses. So then it says that God was good to the Mialdos. Mm-hmm. How was he good to them? The nation increased and became very powerful. That was the goodness that God displayed. That is, if a person is truly righteous, not that he gave them wealth, God gave them wealth, or other kinds of rewards, but sometimes the reward, if a person is truly righteous and they're doing something for a noble ideal, then you don't always know what the outcome will be.
Right. And we don't know if it's this world either.
Right. But for the fact that you did something and you can witness the success of that, because your desire was that the nation should grow.
Mm-hmm. That's even better.
Right. So that's the reward. The reward for the righteous consists in the fact that the goal that they had in mind that motivated them, they actually have the benefit of seeing it come to fruition. That's a tremendous satisfaction. So that's what it says, that God was good to them and the nation increased. Good to them, the nation increased. Then it says, and it was because the midwives feared God, so he built for them houses. That's a very hard one. What do you mean he built for them houses? What kind of houses? What are we talking about? So Rashi's explanation is that positions of leadership. Because Rashi is learning that it's really Miriam and Yocheved.
Right.
So the two houses, Miriam's descendant was, he says, houses of the Kahuna, Kohen.
Right.
That was the dynasty, so to speak. Houses here is like in the sense of dynasty and kingship. Which is also called, the term house is used. And Rashi draws sources where it's referred to as the house of God. The house of God. So that's a reference to the temple. That's the kahuna, Kohen. And the house of the king. Okay. Because the kahuna and the Levites, that's the Levites, they became the ministers in the temple. They came from Yocheved,
right.
Who, Aaron. That was, and the Malchus, the kingship, came from Miriam, because she married into the tribe of Yehuda, and the kingship comes from the tribe of Yehuda. So as Rabbi Feinstein explained, that this deed, see, because the most important quality that renders a person to be a leader, whether it be a leader in terms of the service of God in the temple, or to be a leader in terms of the political, those are the two institutions of leadership in the Jewish people.
Right.
The most important quality of a leader is not necessarily that they're the smartest person, or the most capable person, or the most talented person. Over and above, it's the fear of God.
Right.
And that's a very important lesson. Because if a leader has all these qualities, but doesn't fear God, then watch out for his own ego, his own desire for power and politics. It's all politics. And that's what you see. How many politics, even in not just America, but even in Israel, fighting each person. It's not what's good for the people. It's the desire for power. And even in the religious sphere, you have problems in the religious sphere. That's why we have so many different groups and there's arguments and this and that. If in so many of these issues could be alleviated, could be helped, if the parties were motivated by a real fear of God and wanted to do that which was best, as opposed to their own personal ego, prestige, and so on and so forth. That's true in America, but as I said, it's not, I mean, you can see today, both this side, that side, everybody's concerned about his own position, and nobody is stopping to ask, what's really good for the benefit of the nation? Is this really good? This kind of fighting up and back and the accusations, this is really good. It's not good for the nation. It's weakening the nation. And as I said, I don't want to single out America. You find that in Israel as well, which is a small country surrounded by enemies. And what they really need is to get together and decide to maybe give up my ego and what's best for the nation. You don't find that. Because this principle that the ultimate determining factor in terms of leadership, this is the teaching, they deserved to be the progenitors of the leaders because they display this ultimate fear of God. So that's extremely important teaching. And okay, I think that'll be it for tonight.
Cool.
Okay, everybody. Next week, I think same time, we can still do 6:15. And then we'll probably have to make a change after that, but just keep posted on the newsletter. All right, take care, everybody. Have a good week.
Yeah, Shikor. That's funny.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay, take care. Bye. That was interesting.
Yeah.